guest took some time to watch a very popular TV series and came away with quite mixed emotions. We'll find out what and why in just a moment. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. And I'm very pleased to introduce to you Dr. Kelly Cressup, who is the author of A Love-Hate Guide to Breaking Bad. Kelly Cressup, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you, Pamela. It's good to be here.
Now, Kelly, I understand that you are an instructor at the University of Maryland in Maryland, obviously, the professional writing program. You're an author, you're a storyteller, you're a workshop leader. You are a busy individual.
Yes, I am.
Tell us, with all the things that you're doing, what prompted you to actually watch and write about Breaking Bad?
I think initially the impetus was seeing its rating on Metacritic, the aggregate film and TV site. I saw that the fifth season of Breaking Bad had received a 99 rating. That's 99 out of 100, which I thought was a typographical error. And I thought, I've got to check this out. And when I did start watching the show, and this was after the TV series was finished, I got engrossed, and then I got further engrossed and kept watching. I would say I felt hijacked by the series, although I didn't binge watch it. I watched it in 20-minute segments over the winter of 2013-2014, and it riveted me as a viewer and then also as a writer.
And I would think as a storyteller, too.
Hey, very much so. I think a lot of my respect for the series has to do with the incredible storytelling force and power that it has.
Well, let's just step back for a second, because I'd like the audience to know a little bit more about Kelly Cressup. Tell us more about who you are. Clearly, you are a lover of words and creativity. Tell us a little bit about you.
I was a film and theater reviewer in Seattle in my 20s, and then a graduate student in English literature in my 30s. Watching this show and then writing about it, I think, helped me reaccess the passion for writing that I had as a younger man, and then connect it with the map-making skills that I developed in graduate school. The part of me that has always wanted to be just writing about something that's a little beyond my capacity to take in was activated with this show, as it was with a few really controversial movies back in the 1980s. So this was a chance for me to dive back into that and find a different way of writing. I'm also from the Pacific Northwest and grew up in Portland, Oregon, and I think there's something about that that connects me to this show in terms of it's being set in Albuquerque as opposed to mid-Atlantic or eastern city. And also being an educator, which I've been since I was in my early 20s. The main character in Breaking Bad starts out as a high school chemistry teacher. And there's a connection there that I think is operative. The being a middle class white guy also connects me to this show, I would say. Those are some of the things that come to mind.
You heard me introduce you as an instructor at the University of Maryland professional writing.
Yes.
So many people will talk to potential writers about the importance of writing what you know. And yet what you talk about is writing in a lot of ways about what you didn't know and having to go back in and do research and do a different kind of work than if you were writing something that you just knew off the top of your head. Can you say a little bit more about the difference between writing what you know and writing what you learn?
Yes, I would say the research for this started with watching it on Netflix, which is a different mode than going to a library and noodling through stacks. I would say that a part of me had to do research talking to people. I don't have a long history of drug use or abuse. And there are quite a few characters in this series who are either addicts or nearly addicts or trying to recover. And I didn't have much direct access to that. I also didn't want to just come across as a scold. So what I did was talk to a number of people that have tried or were previously involved with crystal methamphetamine, and did some research online, and really also talked with relatives of people who have dealt with drug abuse. The one that stands out most vividly for me was a woman who was a clerk at a Barnes & Noble in Charlottesville. I was coming to see if the store had anything to do with the TV series Breaking Bad. The woman confirmed in the catalog that they didn't, and then she set her professional decorum aside and said she hates the show sight unseen. She has no interest in watching it, and then she told me that her son has a drug problem. And I had a moment of wanting to just back up a 5 minutes and really talk to her in that capacity instead of as a writer about the show. But there was a part of me that wanted to advocate for her, because after all, nobody should force her to watch a series that has to do with this issue. And she is, I think, voiceless in the conversations about Breaking Bad. And anyone who's seen it might feel like, well, the artistic merits of the show really trump any other effect, you know. So what I'm trying to do is revive the sense of there is a downside to this show, while still understanding that it's an amazing show.
Well, for those who don't know anything about Breaking Bad, except that it exists, because it certainly has had a lot of press over the years, can you give us a thumbnail sketch of what Breaking Bad is all about?
Yes. Initially, the character Walter White is a high school chemistry teacher, married with one son and another child on the way, living in Albuquerque. He also moonlights as at a car wash, which he's pretty embarrassed by, but he's not in the tenure track university setting, and so he has to really scramble to make ends meet. In the midst of that, in the pilot episode, he receives a cancer diagnosis that leaves him reeling and unable to know what to do about his future, especially providing for his family. His choice is to make and sell crystal meth and to partner up with someone who was a former student of his at high school. So that's the premise of the series. And we also see a man who is related. His brother-in-law is a DEA agent.
Oh, boy.
And so you could say that there's a series that's premised as a cat and mouse battle or race between one man and another man who's trying to catch him but doesn't know that it's actually his brother-in-law.
That's a really interesting twist. And the title, Breaking Bad, what's that about?
It's Southern slang for, I think, going to extremes, being a badass. I'm not from the tradition that uses it regularly in speech, but there's a sense of really going to extremes and finding your way past traditional morality if you have to. Going to extremes is the best thing I can think of in terms of a shorthand.
the idea of going to extremes if you have to. Certainly people have that experience in their lives, and people do all kinds of things, and the definition of extremes in and of itself can be extreme. As you, as a storyteller and as a professional writer, as you think about the idea of a whole series that is in part a look at how this chemistry instructor, nice guy, middle class guy, perhaps lower middle class guy, really trying to make ends meet, and then just really going down a very different path. What's your thought about that?
The showrunner, Vince Gilligan, his pitch line for the series was, you take Mr. Chips and turn him into Scarface. Mr. Chips being a beloved educator from a classic film from the early, I think it's the 20s. So his notion was that we're going to take this man to extremes and laden him with things beyond which normal people would, buckle, and see what would happen if this man moved from being a milquetoast to, as I said, a badass. And I find that the premise is compelling in ways that leave me, well, I recall other extreme shows. The Sopranos is one that comes to mind. This is a more radical treatment of character than Tony Soprano in that series, because we see somebody come unhinged. We see him initially move toward illegal behavior to support, ostensibly to support his family after his death. But Walter continues to make meth long after he has made enough money to support his family many times over. He doesn't get out of the meth trade. He finds he really likes it. And despite all the mayhem and the violence and the downsides, he really just gets into it well over, even after his wife finds out and resists it. So there's something about that that really is jarring. I think it's upsetting to me in terms of my own background. I was a pretty nice guy at some point. I hope that I still am many times, right? And yet there's something about that speaks to me as being nice sometimes isn't enough.
It sounds like you might be saying that there's almost a sexiness, if you will, to the way Walter goes from being regular man on the street to this sort of super wealthy drug kingpin. There's something compelling or even seductive about that process. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, indeed. And in fact, I've seen that in a number of contexts. The seminar, the honor seminar that I helped to teach at the University of Maryland over several semesters, I saw students in the class who raised their hand and kept raising it when the question was, are you entirely in touch with Walter? And at what point in the series are you not in touch with him? There was no point at which they were not in touch and supporting him fully. And it's as if they had blanked out on all the downsides to the character, all the mayhem, the manipulation, the exploitation. So there is something very odd and disturbing about this man becoming a badass, becoming this killer who justifies everything for this supposed altruistic goal of supporting his family, and he becomes pathological. And we have criminals who have become folk heroes in the past. I think of Don Corleone in The Godfather. And I think it's time to complicate our view of Walter White, because some people only see the badass. They only see the Heisenberg alias that he's known as, and he's confronting people in this mode, and people look up to that and they see that's just astounding. And I think it's time to look past that, because the series helps us do this, but some people are blanking out on some of the subtlety and some of the complexity that helps us see that.
Hence a love-hate guide to Breaking Bad.
Indeed.
The idea... Yes.
I have a precedent for love-hate guide. My initial book project back in graduate school was about Andy Warhol, and I had to get over my intense resentment and hatred of Andy Warhol to write that book and to find why I legitimately love him right now. It helped to sort of form a precedent for the current book project.
Why such extreme reactions to Andy Warhol? What did that bring up for you?
In my 20s, as I mentioned, I was a film and theater critic in Seattle. I was also a freelance artist, and I was selling my watercolors at $7 to $10 at Pike Place Market in Seattle, and some days I went home without selling anything. What little I knew about Andy Warhol at the time, well, he was plagiarizing popular images, getting friends to do a lot of the work of actually painting them, turning them into silk screens. He was charging astronomical sums and living the life of a Studio 54 gadfly. And I saw that, and I really just saw everything that was cynical about the art world. So when I got to graduate school, and this was in English literature, not in art history, well, suddenly Andy was what everyone was talking about, and it took me a while to realize he was really at the core of what I found most intellectually passionate. Popular culture, gay and lesbian studies, postmodernism. So I held on to my initial response. I didn't just erase it, but I would say that I turned a resentment into a positive anger. So love-hate guide to Andy Warhol. And now to Breaking Bad.
Again, moving aside from Breaking Bad for a moment, there are many people who have grown up in families where the goal was, yes, to go to college, yes, to have a career, but to have a career in which you could make money. And everybody knows you don't make any money if you're studying English lit or professional writing, or even being an academic. How did you navigate that as you were going through your studies? Were your parents supportive of your academic pursuits?
They were, although I paid for half of my undergraduate career and I paid for all of my 8 years of graduate school while also supporting myself as a teacher within University of Virginia's English program. I had taught and worked overseas in Tokyo for a few years before graduate school. And that paid for the first year of graduate school for me. I was self-supporting. I've always had an artistic temperament. And also, I just more or less realized that I wasn't going to be hugely reimbursed for that. And yet, the more important thing for me was, am I able to work through what I see as my life mission, and that's been the driving factor.
So, in fact, there is life and work after studying English lit.
Yes, yes, I'm happy to say.
Kelly Cressup, author of A Love-Hate Guide to Breaking Bad. We're going to take a break, and when we will come back, we will continue with this look at Walter and more of this series.
Thank you.
Kelly, at one point in Breaking Bad, you say that you see the series as a wake-up call, and then you say, and I quote, "I don't know what it's waking us up to." Tell us some more about that thought.
Yes, it's all over the map in terms of responses to the most complex character I've ever encountered, either in fiction or in film or visual media. If you find yourself connecting with Walter White at one point, you may find you're disconnecting with him a minute later, and then disagreeing with yourself maybe an episode or so later. The people around him also have layered lives, and I found that I couldn't entirely separate myself from the series. It was like a vortex in some ways. It was just kind of incorporating and full immersion. And I think that's one of the ways that I felt, not only as a viewer, but as a writer, I needed to contend with it so that I could place it or find a way out of the vortex, if you will.
Is it scary to think about oneself as initially connecting with the lead character? He's a regular guy. He's got a job. He's got a family. You know, he's got a part-time job. He's a regular guy. So connecting with that, and then down the road, finding yourself connecting with this drug kingpin who's involved in all kinds of nefarious activities. Is that jarring?
It is. I want to admit that I initially really wanted him to go back to some of his original habits. There's an episode in season one where he goes to the birthday party of a former graduate school chemistry associate, and he sees what that man's life has become. They are former partners, and he has a girlfriend who's become that man's wife. And it's a possibility of getting his cancer treatment completely funded by this friend and coming back into the fold of becoming a chemist again. And it tells you a lot about Walter that he doesn't allow it. He won't go there. There's a cussedness about him, and there's a pride about him that won't allow it, even if his friend bankrolls it and he's just not able to accept that. I think the fact that I wanted him to go back to the safe folds of academe tells you a little about me. And yet there's another part of me that never felt maybe 100% that academe was the entirety. So I've had to break bad, if you will, in moving away from, I guess the notion that I was going to be a tenure track professor. I feel there's a part of me that has had to make do with certain realities around me. I'm speaking not just as an artist, but as an educator. The prizes are different now. And I didn't have to do a moonlighting car wash job as Walter did, but I can point to equivalents in my 20s and 30s when I was supporting myself and really having to do things other than be an artist to support the projects that I really had the most passion for.
The change in which one can experience oneself when you are confronted with perhaps the truth or at least the broadening of what you find interesting, of what appeals to you on some levels. Again, it's an awakening perhaps of a part of you that you weren't aware of yourself. You know, to bring the question full circle, Walter's a great guy, and then he's a drug kingpin. And, you know, I think about the folks who have been watching the series who saw themselves as that great guy, kind of milquetoast guy, and then found themselves really kind of fascinated with the person that Walter became, and perhaps being unnerved about the person he became. I wonder how many folks took themselves into therapy as a result of this, as a result of their reaction to this series.
I wonder about that myself. I haven't talked with anyone specifically who has done that, but I know the conversations that I had told me that people were obsessing about the series. I know from my nephew's response, he had to stop watching it because it gave him nosebleeds. I talked with one or two other people who said they had panic attacks while watching the show. So the question of being unnerved, I really get it. And I also, while wrestling with the series and contending with it, I found that it was quite, I had to have psychic bailouts from time to time because it was so punishing in some ways. I felt that I had to do it and to press myself further into it. And still, it was punishing. And I do respect the writers of the series to that extent because they also put themselves at risk and created really punishing scenarios for them to write themselves out of.
For those who have not seen the series, I'm not sure that what you've just described would make sense for them. Why would you need a bailout? And I noticed earlier that you said you watched it in 20-minute segments. Why?
That tends to be how I watch things. I only like about an hour of video per day. That's when I have my meals. And binge watching is just not a habit that I think is healthy, at least for me.
Or for anyone.
Also gives some reflection time.
Okay.
For me to step away and to look at a part of an episode and think, okay, I wonder what's happening here and what will happen. And it gives me the time to reflect on it and to step away from it and to consider my reactions.
So for you, that was just a natural way to view things, as you've just said. For these other folks for whom it was creating so much intensity, what are your thoughts about that?
In Walter White, you see someone who is brought to the core of his own belief system. You see him writing it out at one point. He's sitting on a toilet and just trying to decide about his own reaction to an extreme situation that involves a drug dealer that he may have to kill so as to survive himself. And he's writing out on a list on a piece of paper reasons to do it, reasons to not do it. And the reasons not to do it, well, there are quite a lot of things he writes down, including Judeo-Christian ethics. It's just not right to kill and so forth. He has quite a few elements. Well, eventually he does kill the man, not because he reasoned it out, but because of force of circumstance. The scene in which that happens is so upsetting, so viscerally well done in terms of making both players subjectively active people, people that we care about. And one of them is a corpse after the scene finishes, and it's very upsetting. And it's not that far into the series. I think it's the third or fourth episode. So people who've been watching in a casual way up until that point, hoping for a diversion, are going to have to make a choice. And it's really not so much a head choice as a stomach choice of do I have the fortitude to carry through with this series. Scenes like that are viscerally hard to watch, not so much just because of the violence, but because we care about the characters, because they are layered people and we can see aspects of ourselves in them.
So the idea that you could just watch this series and be unaffected by it, it sounds like that's almost not possible if you're human.
For me, I think that's true. I can imagine maybe that's possible for other people. I know people binge watched it and I wonder how much they got from it and how much they missed. There's a lot of artistic content that has rewarded second and third viewings for me. And still that first gut clenching sense of, OMG, I can't believe I'm watching this. I can't be watching it, and I'm watching it. There's a kind of a contradictory thing that the series unleashes, I think, and it's really quite unnerving. And it gets more so as the series continues. It's not a series that relaxes with itself. You could say that the bar kept getting higher and that this series ended on a season that took the biggest risks that it had taken.
How so?
Things really ratchet up in season five, not just in the ratings. I mean, the critical response, the 99 was unique. It wasn't something that happened in the first season, which was partially derailed or shortened by the writer's strike. The conditions become so dire, and some of the most beloved characters from the series face life or death situations. And again, the writer's room was taking high level risks that I can't think of many equivalents in other series, and really pressing in. They would solve problems only after having created the problems. They didn't know the answers in ahead of time, and they sometimes were just strung out for weeks trying to solve a certain problem. But that translates in screen time to our watching a scene and just not knowing quite how to respond because it's so extreme. And the family, the stress to the family, both Walt and his wife and his son, as well as the brother-in-law, Hank, are made to face, well, again, life or death situations and unprecedented levels of stress in their own lives.
Is there a way, in your view, to not be so affected by the series? And I ask that because clearly you are someone who appreciates art, you appreciate words and language and creativity and storytelling. You appreciate that, you value that. For somebody who is not of that ilk, could they watch the series and just see it as a TV show and that's the end of that, do you think?
I don't know that that's entirely possible. I did talk to a few people that I very much respect who said, no, too much violence, too much mayhem, too dark, that's not for me. I don't think that I've heard altogether that many responses of the extreme nature, the nosebleeds or the panic attacks. So I don't want to put that out as a typical response.
Okay.
Still, the conversation that was happening at the time, I mean, I was just incredibly surprised to find strangers willing to talk about this series and to leap over several of the, you know, traditional barriers that keep us. I was on a bus from New York City to D.C., about 4.5-hour bus ride, that happened to put me next to a guy in his 20s. And you never know what's going to happen on a bus ride, and you sometimes strike a conversation, you sometimes don't. And I happened to start a conversation. It drifted toward Breaking Bad. We had a 3-hour marathon talk about the series. And every time we kind of drifted away from the series, the energy went flat. This guy even gave me his phone number because I hadn't watched the last 2 episodes yet. I swore him to secrecy. I told him not to give me any spoilers. And I talked with him a few days later after I'd finished the series. That has never happened in my life, where a stranger on a bus becomes somebody who I feel a complete solidarity with. And again, a 3-hour marathon conversation. So I guess it is possible to have a more casual response to the show. But then I'm also wondering, why bother, you know, if able to get underneath our skin and our conventional responses to things, then there's something that says to me, why bother? Or just, okay, this isn't the right show for you, so look for another one. But I really do see art as, at least in its possibilities of getting from us really visceral responses that get past the intellectual places we go to, usually the kind of just ordinary cud chewing moments that we have during the day, and really, really get to us past our defenses.
And it certainly sounds like Breaking Bad was an experience that did that for you and for many others.
Yes, I think so. I wrote about this partly in the violence chapter, dealing with the downsides of violence, and also recognizing there are moments when violence in a television series can be a way of saying, wake up, see this reality for what it is. We can't make this pretty. It's part of a really unpleasant fact of existence, and this is our way, using all of the skills that we have, the responsibility, the social and ethical concerns that we have, and still wake up and see this. Don't underestimate us, and don't take a view of life that is divorced from this as a possibility. See it not as a model to emulate, but as a reality that you have to confront. And that, I really do admire the series when it does that.
Well, and that sort of brings me to another point, because in so many ways, you know, the idea that you could engage in illegal activities and make a fortune and in theory live on Easy Street and be reasonably okay seems to be a part of what Walter experiences. So to hear you acknowledge and to talk about the downsides of that kind of a lifestyle and those kinds of decisions in a way that says to the public, you know, maybe not such a good idea, maybe you really do need to rethink this a little bit, quite frankly, is I don't know, somewhat comforting to me.
Yes, I try to bring some of the nice guy or the, you know, the Christian upbringing that I had to this, while recognizing that the codes have changed and art is not necessarily always about a rosy ending or a neat moral conclusion. So it is visceral in that sense. And yeah, I can't let that go either. Nor is Vince Gilligan, as the showrunner, letting go entirely of ethical questions about what are the consequences of our actions. He said that he lost, metaphorically, a year of his life worrying about the ending of this series. And I think that's not just for technical reasons of what to do with the character, but really beyond that, how to meet justice out. In a world that doesn't always have just endings, he still knew that art has the power and has the responsibility to connect us to these deeper questions. And we feel a certain way of needing to work out our own ethical issues. So he doesn't ignore those either.
Kelly Cressip, author of A Love-Hate Guide to Breaking Bad. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue. So you stay where you are. lastly, you reference pregnant women who smoke, suburban wives stealing from open houses, underage children getting liquor. What do you make all of this as you think about, thought about, and wrote about Breaking Bad?
Yes, nobody gets to be a paragon of virtue in this show. Even the DEA agent, the brother-in-law of the main character, has his Cuban cigars, which he admits are illicit, right? And I think people get to have both positive and negative qualities in this show, things that they're proud of and things that they're not proud of. So again, no paragons of virtue. And there's some way in which everyone has to deal with really hard moments or crises, and whatever they may espouse officially has to contend with that. So there's this moment when Walt is lying on his back under the crawl space below his house. He's looking for a chunk of money, $600,000 or more, that he's hidden there, and he needs to get that and leave town with his family so that he can survive a drug kingpin coming after him with intent to kill his entire family. He finds at that space, his wife looks down at him and tells him that she gave that money, most of it, to a man that she's actually been having an affair with. Now, most people would say, well, that's a ridiculous scenario. How did we ever get there? It takes several seasons to get there. The rational response for Walt would be to start calculating how to generate money or how to deal with the situation rationally. We've seen that part of him, the rational man, and yet that's not what's going to be his response in this moment. He starts cackling maniacally in the face of the situation, in the face of his wife. It doesn't make sense, and yet something inside of him combusts, and it lets us see that there's something past just simply reasoning it through or saying, what's the ethical thing to do here? It's a really galvanizing moment in the series and something I've never seen on TV. I think even just a six-year-old happened to walk into the room would say, that's just really not like TV ever that I've seen before.
Indeed. There's so much that is floating about these days having to do with the issues of race and gender and class and you name it, tons of isms. Is any of that, in your view, addressed in Breaking Bad?
Yes and no. I would say it does deal with race and gender issues indirectly and in offhand ways, but then politics and ethics are scrambled on the show. Gus Fring is one of Walt's main partners and then adversaries. He's a black man who's probably gay, though he has meticulously purged himself of all outward signs of a racial identity or a love life. Speech, bearing, attire, entirely purged of any hint of his racial, ethnic, geographic origin. He started life in Chile, but you'd never know it. And he's really covered his tracks. So how do we get to the core of this man who is trying so hard to come across as outwardly to the community as a civic booster, as an entrepreneur? He manages a chain of fried chicken, fast food restaurants. So how do you get to him and how do you deal with race in any direct way? There's no direct way. And the show is pretty offhand and indirect in that sense. On gender, well, Skyler, Walter White's wife, is a strong female character who initially takes a bad rap from her husband, her son, and even from viewers. She starts out in a more limited capacity as a pregnant woman who nags her husband a lot. However, she has the intelligence to put the clues together about her husband's behavior, and she does coerce out of him what he's doing in his moonlighting career as a meth creator. She eventually uses her bookkeeping skills toward helping him launder money. And I would say, despite the illicit nature of that, she represents the kind of business savvy that some women acquire after reaching middle age. There's a formidable side of her, and Anna Gunn is just a terrific actress to have created this, despite the hits she took. And there are people who can't stand her and really rally about hating Skyler. The actress took a death threat at one point for portraying this woman, which doesn't make sense at all, right? But I really admire that part of her, the stepping forward into her powers. Vince Gilligan told the actress Anna Gunn, this series is about Carmela Soprano eventually joining sides with Tony Soprano. And that was before she joined the series. So she knew the stakes, and going from being pregnant and in the dark to being a formidable force, there's something about female empowerment that gets really exciting for me. And she deservedly took at least one Emmy for the role, I think more than one. Mm. But in season five, she has to defend her child, her infant daughter, in the most dire of situations. And I don't think I've ever seen a more riveting female acted scene on television.
When you talk about the actress getting a death threat, you know, in some ways, not surprising in that there are people who, as they get more and more engaged in whatever they're doing, you know, I think about soap operas where viewers would write in to warn one of the actors or actresses that somebody was cheating on them or out to get them. I mean, you know, these soap operas, in essence, these shows that come on once a week with running characters, they really do become a part of some of the viewers' everyday life. So it doesn't surprise me that she would get a death threat. What I wonder about is your view of the impact of this series with its varying layers, to borrow one of your words, and the varying inferences about living a quote-unquote good legal life versus a maybe not so good but really powerful and in some ways fun-laden illegal life.
I think most people would say that the milquetoast Walt that we see initially is really not to anyone's liking. He just doesn't have a much of a spinal column. And yet the series turns him into this Scarface character who makes just terrible decisions, and not just illegal, but quite immoral, and repeatedly kills people. So we're pitched into a situation where there's no simple part of Walt to affirm, although he does have lovely scenes with his daughter. And I think it does put us all into a kind of cauldron or a vortex where we have to say, okay, whatever my map was, it's not serving me, at least for the space of time I'm watching this series. So to be pitched out of your traditional response to something, and also sympathizing with, I mean, this series has a bead on some of the real realities of post-2007 United States life, with the economic downturn, with complications in finding health care, job market conditions for certain individuals, especially young men. There are certain realities there that are, I think, really hard to just distance yourself from, regardless of what you feel about the individual characters. There are themes and there's a social concern that does draw you in.
Do you think that writers of ongoing series versus, you know, the one-shot 30, 60-minute program have a different responsibility to the viewers, to the listeners, than those who create the, you know, one-hour or two-hour programs, simply because the characters are so much more real in a series versus in a one- or two-hour program? Do the writers have a different duty to the public?
I think they do. It is really more like a long-term relationship versus a quick fix or a overnight, one-night stand, I guess, to put it in relationship terms. There's something about how we reach for our televisions on a given evening. This is scrambled, of course, in the age of the internet, where people can binge watch. Still, this series initially came out on AMC 1 week at a time. And so people built up a certain identification and felt connected and then dismayed and riveted and repulsed. And they did develop connections. I do think that it's really different from a series or a single two-hour, let's say, made-for-TV movie. The difference also for the writers is that they don't always know if they're going to get a second season or even something beyond a pilot. So they have to create a pilot sort of going out on a limb and just not knowing. And I think a lot of them have the frustration of knowing, okay, we've got to bring people in and put out major stakes. And we can't just seem totally irresponsible about how we do that. So we've got to make something that would both be satisfying as a single episode or as a single season, but then also leave enough going for the next season to come along. I live in the Washington, D.C. area. I have some friends who are in L.A. and working in the industry, and it always surprises me, oh, their lives are really different than what I imagined. I'm glad that I'm not doing that in a week-to-week kind of way. And I do hope that they remember, hey, there are nutrients in your show, or there can be, and we can also get positive messages even if the character or the main character is a badass.
There are those who say, I am creating simply for the purpose of creating, whether it's a story, a movie, a piece of artwork. I don't have an obligation to be an ethical, humanistic individual. I'm just creating, and it has its own value in the creation of it. I don't have to pay attention to anything but that. What do you think about that concept? Do you agree with that?
I have a personal preference for shows like Friday Night Lights or the rebooted Battlestar Galactica, because I do think that they have a closer, more vital connection to the questions you're raising about how do we become more humane individuals? How do we deal directly with the political crises of our era and find some spark of nobility inside ourselves? That's not what television has done a lot of recently. I noticed in 2014, the best drama candidates were all dark shows about cold people, Mad Men, Game of Thrones, House of Cards, True Detective, all dark shows. And I asked myself, are these shows dark out of urgent conviction or just coasting on a national mood? And if we are living in dark times, is dark art what we really need for sustenance, for reminding us that there are better options? I think it's worth thinking about. I noticed that the director, British director Mike Lee, is known for dark, difficult content, movies like Secrets and Lies or Vera Drake. His response after the housing and financial crisis of 2008 was to come out with the optimistic happy-go-lucky movie, and it was delightful. And it wasn't just strictly a walk in the park. Still, there's something about that that tells me artists can be responsible in the deepest way. They can give us models for characters to emulate, as well as characters that we would not want to emulate. It did concern me that Breaking Bad was called by many news sources a cautionary tale, and I believe that whatever caution is being missed, that at some level this maybe is a failed cautionary tale. People missed the memo that you don't emulate Walter White.
I fear you may be right in some, certainly in some circles, if not many circles. Kelly Cressup, as we close out our time together today, what would you like the reader of A Love-Hate Guide to Breaking Bad to come away with?
I hope they get really engaged with the series through the writing and the writing through the series. I hope that it provokes ideas. I hope that if you have a casual relationship to the show or you like it, like about 11 million people do on Facebook, that they rethink and refeel their relation to the series and see, what am I missing? What did I go through by only seeing this episode once? What did I miss? What is still waiting for me? And how can I complicate my relation to the show and to the main character? I'd like to say that as a summary to a few things to get from the book.
Where can listeners get more information about what you're doing and about the book?
Oh, two websites, lovehatebreakingbad.com and my own website, laughingmuse.com.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Dr. Kelly Cressup, for bringing us a really thoughtful conversation about, as you've said, what has almost become a part of the American language, Breaking Bad.
Thank you, Pamela.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand by going to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. And I would love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to this conversation today on Mind Talk. So do send an email to me, Pamela, Pamela, at mindtalk.org. And again, that's mindtalk.org. You can go to the Mind Talk site and learn more about the various platforms on which you can listen to Mind Talk, but you can certainly download the Mind Talk app or follow it on iTunes. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.